Why do the series on the book of Revelation right now? To answer that question, we have to ask about the book. Why was the book written? And if you have to ask why the book was written, you have to ask a couple of questions as well. What kind of book is this book? When was the book written? Where was the book written? And then finally, you will see why was the book written. And with that question answered, we'll see why we are preaching this in 2023, the end of the year. So let's go straight into it. The book was written in 92 to 96 AD, approximately 50, 60 years after Jesus died. Yes, he rose, but he also left. The disciples saw him ascend into heaven, and he was supposed to be back. Nobody knows how long he's going to be gone for, and nobody knows where he is right now. Now, life hasn't been the easiest since Jesus left. There are all the complications that come with a new church, which essentially is a brand new movement. We have the Jewish believers still disagreeing with the new Christian faith. There's persecution from the Jewish community, like the people like Saul. They would arrest Christians and put them into jail. And on the other hand, the church was struggling to establish its identity. What do they do? What can they do? What should they do? And all the churches from this area have their mess, their issues and things they have to deal with. This one just kicked out some members. This one just had a bunch of members leave. This one just had a bunch of controversies with them. The leader resigned, the pastor resigned, the staff left. This one is not sure where they stand on this controversial issue. And this one just had a huge disagreement between themselves on what stance they should take on this government rule. Everybody's asking, who are we looking to? Who's the leader? Who calls the shots? Who decides things? And there's worry, and there's confusion, and there's anxiety. What do we do at this time? Not only that, things outside of the church hasn't really helped at all. The king at this time in Rome is the Roman Emperor Nero. Nero was brutal. He was cruel. There was a fire in Rome, and he blamed the Christians for it and killed many of the brothers and sisters. And because of that, the Roman officials clashed with the Christians all the time. And in 66 AD, the Romans had it enough. They sent four legions of 5,000 soldiers each and completely just ran over Jerusalem. That second temple that you thought was so glorious, which was already a shadow of the past, that temple, completely gone, destroyed again. Everything inside the temple was taken out, essentially paraded, like the veil that supposedly covered the holy place, the furniture, the lampstands, everything in there, paraded. Not only that, the high priest at that time was murdered. And so what you have is the Old Testament belief system, religious system, how you connect with God, how you know all this in the Old Testament is just completely wiped out. Not only that, the people that founded the churches, you know, Apostle Paul, Apostle Peter, the 12 disciples, one by one by one, they were captured, they were killed, they were crucified, they were exiled, they were persecuted, and all of them died. Maybe Rome is the actual new kingdom. Maybe they are actually the one that decides things around here. A couple years later, that Emperor Nero committed suicide. Now everything is just a mess. Everybody is fighting each other. Rome itself is killing each other. Everything is on fire. Everybody is killing everybody. What is going on? Nothing in this world is normal anymore. Does anybody know what is going on in this world? A few years later, new emperor is on the scene. You think it'd be better, but no, because his name is Domitian. Domitian made what was already a very messy and confusing and difficult time to be a Christian even worse. He was a profoundly insecure man, and in order to compensate for his insecurity as a king, what did he do? He ordered all the citizens and subjects of the Roman Empire to worship him as God. And so you would find golden statues of him everywhere. And if you disrespected his statues, you'd be punished. And at every event, every cinema, every marketplace, every coliseum, you'll find a little altar. You don't have to do much. You just have to take a pinch of incense, throw it into the altar, and say, Caesar is Lord. And if you don't do it, you have committed treason. So when Christians were found to go onto the streets and they would skip the altar, when they don't bow before the throne, Domitian ordered them to be beaten, thrown into the jail, exiled into the island to rot and die. It is difficult to be a Christ follower at that time. If you don't make a stance, people will cancel you. If you make a stance that they don't like, they cancel you. If you do what everybody else is doing, if you don't do what everybody else is doing, you get called out, you get isolated, you get punished, you get laughed at. So now there's fear in every Christian's heart. There's worry. What if we get caught? What if they find out? What if they find out I'm a Christian? What if they ask me that question? I would just never go out then. What do you do? Because you see, the Romans have a king. You don't know where yours is. Now, the alternative to all of this is very tempting. The alternative to all of this is very tempting. Because if you would just pick in that little incense, pretty harmless phrase, Caesar's king, just dump it into that little altar, do what everybody else is doing, say whatever they want you to say, do what people want you to do, the alternative is the good life. Not only do you get to live freely, live as a normal citizen, you can enjoy life. Enjoy the entertainment that comes with living as a Roman citizen. So many people want to become a Roman citizen. The gladiator games, the theater, the arts, the movies, the business, the party, the one-night stands, and all of that. Because, come on, life is short. Life is short. Enjoy it. Why so serious? It's just a little phrase. It's just a little gesture. You don't really mean it. That sex club at the Venus Temple, it's a little sketchy, I know, but this new friend brought you. It wasn't you. You didn't do anything to, you know. Doing that business with the prophet from Jupiter's Temple, that is a little borderline, but I mean, you gotta make a living somehow. And you see, there's so many gods and goddesses in the Roman pantheon that maybe Jesus is just one of the many. Because the problem is the Romans have a king. Yours is nowhere to be found. Well, you believe in him still, but he's somewhere. He don't know. So you still go to church. You still listen to the sermons. You still do things, but Rome is cool. Life is short. Don't take it so seriously anymore. Come on. It's under this context that the book of Revelation was written. It's under this time that God has something to say to his people. His words came to a pastor exiled on an island called Patmos. Exiled because he was unwilling to do what everybody else was doing. He was doing the difficult thing. He was John the Apostle. One day he was worshiping and praying, and he was probably praying for all the churches in that area, concerned for his brothers and sisters. He was concerned for their well-being, yes. He was concerned for their safety, yes. But more importantly, concerned for their faith. Concerned for their perseverance. And so during his worship and prayer time, he received a word from God, or more accurately, he received visions from God, which he was told to write down and send it to the believers all over the world. Send it to the people who are having to make tough choices. Send it to the people who have already made the right choice. Send it to the people who think they should make the right choice but are struggling. Send it to them so they can read it. They can hear it. They can see it. And John would quickly write down what he saw on the island, and he begins what he wrote down like this. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his servants the things that must soon take place. John identifies what God reveals to him as a revelation of Jesus Christ. In the original Greek language, it's called Apocalypse of Jesus Christ. John is telling you, you're not just reading an ordinary letter, you're reading apocalyptic literature. This is not a new thing. You've read this in Ezekiel, in Daniel. So when we hear the word apocalypse now, we think zombies, we think pandemic, we think end of the world. But the original meaning, the people would have known this, the original meaning in Greek is not the end of the world. It's simply meant, it's just very simple. It just meant this. It just means open, to open up. It's like opening the curtain of a theater. It's like opening the veil to a drama to show you what's behind the curtain. And when the curtain is open, you are going to see images, you're going to see numbers, you're going to see characters, you're going to see drama, and all of these carry a symbolic meaning, and each of these meanings bring with it a message for the church. And so you have to ask the question, why apocalypse? Why do we need to open the curtain? Why not just write another letter? What does it show you? Because lifting the curtain, you have to remember this as the rest of the series, lifting the curtain does two things. First is it sets the present in light of the unseen realities of the future. It sets the present in light of the unseen realities of the future. When the spiritual curtain opens in Revelation, you see the future. You see what is bound to happen for the history of mankind. You see what's God's will and his plan and how the world will come to a close. When you see the future, you live differently in the present. Your vision of the future affects your actions in the present. The second thing, much more important. Opening the curtain does this. It sets the present in light of the invisible realities of the present. It sets the present in light of the invisible realities of the present. When the curtains open, you see the now, the spiritual dimension now, the spiritual world, the heavenly world. You see, the heavenly world is not somewhere far, far away and up in the galaxy somewhere. It's not just out there. It's not far away from here. It's not somewhere in the universe. You can think of it like another dimension. It's here. It's invisible to your mortal eye, but it's real. And what God allowed John to see is to open that spiritual curtain to see the reality now. And when you see the reality now differently, you live differently. Now, your vision of the present affects your actions in the present. Things are not only as they seem. So to John, who was punished for following Christ, and all the churches and Christ followers who are having to make literally life and death decisions, you know, tough choices, who are risked being isolated and persecuted, who may be laughed at, looked at funny, discriminated, who are thinking maybe some just, I want to take the easy way out. God decides the best message to give them is to show them the reality, to open up the curtain, to show them the future and show them the now. So when that curtain opens, what do you see first? What is the first scene in this drama? What is the most important message that needs to be brought across? What is that first scene that will grab your attention and set everything else in the drama into motion? This is what John heard on that day. He says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet saying, write what you see in a book and send it to the seven churches. Question, why seven? Why not eight? Why not nine? Why not 15? There are surely more than seven churches in the Asia Minor region. As we said before, apocalyptic literature have images and numbers and symbols that carry with it a deeper meaning. And a lot of times, the symbolic meaning is to be taken above the literal meaning. Seven is an important number. Seven is the numbers of days of creation. It's a number that represents completeness, entirety, all. And so the book, The revelation of Jesus Christ is not just to be sent to seven individual churches, but is to be sent to the entire, complete church body. These seven churches represent the church body. So what did John see next? This is the first scene. Then I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning, I saw seven golden lampstands. The number seven again. It's not hard to put these together. We just mentioned the seven churches. John, the first thing he sees is the seven golden lampstands, which he will clarify for you at the end, that this is the seven churches. John sees first the complete church body of Christ. And no wonder, because church has been thinking about them, praying for them this whole time. What happens to the churches? What happens to them? Is the lampstands going to get blown out? Are they going to persevere? Are they going to get captured? Will people leave? Will people follow? What happens to the lampstands? And in the midst of the lampstands, one like a son of man. So what John sees is not what happens to the churches, but who is in the church. And if you translate this literally, in the middle of the church, who is in the middle of the churches? The Son of Man. Who is the Son of Man? You know this. Son of Man is Jesus' title for himself. Turns out, the first thing God reveals to John when that spiritual curtain is lifted is that Jesus first is alive, he is still here, and he is in the middle of the church. Not far, far away, not above somewhere up there in the clouds, not below, certainly, here, in the middle. Yes, things are a little crazy in the world right now. Some of the churches are in a mess. The empires and the governments seem to be winning. There are wars all over the world. Your life might be difficult. You might have temptations every day. The spiritual reality God wants you to see right now is that Jesus is alive, he is present, and he's in the middle of the church. He's only a curtain away. He's much, much, much closer than you think. Things are not only as it seems. Now, what is Jesus like? How is Jesus being depicted? What does John see? Jesus is clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash around his chest. Long robe with a golden sash around his chest, that is the king's outfit. You know what that tells you? Domitian might be on the throne right now. There are a lot of people now that seem like they have a lot of control over politics and economics and government and wars. Don't be mistaken. There's only one king, and he is the king. He is in the middle of the church. This king is here in the middle of the church. Put it another way. His White House, his throne room, his headquarters is the church. That's the king. This outfit is also the priest's outfit. The priest might be murdered, yes. The temple might be gone, yes. It does not mean you don't have access to God anymore. It doesn't mean you lost God completely, because Jesus is still here. He is the connection between God and man. He's here in the middle of the church. The church is sacred and holy because Jesus is here. He is the one that connects heaven and earth. The king and the priest is still in the middle of the church. The hairs of Jesus' head were white, like white wool, like snow. Jesus' hair is white like snow. And I'm going to try to make a comparison. This is going to be slightly blasphemous. The closest comparison I can find is Gandalf the White. Have you seen Lord of the Rings? White hair, what's the symbol of white hair? It's agelessness, timelessness. Jesus has been here longer than Domitian, longer than Nero, longer than all the kings, and he's still here, even till now. What's the color of white? What does that mean? Symbol of purity, of perfection, of holiness, of wisdom. Jesus is so pure that he radiates holiness. He is perfect without flaw. He is here in the middle of his church. his eyes were like a flame of fire. It means he sees through things. He sees through you. He sees through the mask that you've put on and your outward appearance. Goes all the way to the mind and the heart, and he searches it. He knows what you're doing right now. Here, he knows what you're doing right now. He knows what you're thinking about in your mind. He knows what struggle you've gone through the past week, the pain that you've felt in your heart, the uncertainty that you have in your life. He knows. The temptation that you almost fell into, or the one that you did fall into, the attitude that you brought here today, serious, careless, he sees it. He sees you and he sees through you. He also knows what's happening in the church. Is the church faithful? Is the church worshiping? Is the church holy? Is the church pure? He sees all of this. He's not unaware. He's not disinterested. He's not ignorant. He knows that too. He sees it. What's more important? He doesn't just see things and know things. He seeks to purify things, to make them holy and clean. Again, a little bold of a comparison, but imagine Superman's laser eyes. But he doesn't want to burn you to death. He wants to refine you and make you holy like himself. He is here in the middle of the church. His feet were like burnished bronze, refined in the furnace. Have you guys seen Hulkbuster, Iron Man suit made for Hulk? Have you seen his feet? I don't mean Jesus is Iron Man, but I do mean that Jesus is powerful. He is so powerful, he can step over any opposition. You may think that the Romans are stepping over everybody. You may think there are some armies right now in this world, like stepping over all the other countries, but those are nothing in comparison to Jesus' kingdom. He stands firm. He doesn't waver. He doesn't shake. The foundation of his kingdom is strong. All the earthly kingdom will rise and fall for 2,000 years, but only one king and one kingdom remains. He is in the middle of the church. His voice was like the roar of many waters. His words have power and authority. You may think that the Roman emperor has authority, that whatever he said gets done, but Jesus' voice has power over creation itself. When he speaks, everything, including creation, listens to him. Whatever he declares is like a rush of tsunami running over the earth. Nothing can stop it. His voice is powerful. His voice is majestic. It's great. But it's also assuring and peaceful, like the great waves of the ocean. He is in the middle of the church. In his right hand, he held seven stars. The seven stars we read are the angels of the churches, all the churches. All the churches are in Jesus' hands, protected. But also, this is important, the stars were very important to the Romans. The astrologers at that time, they see seven planets up in the world, up in the sky, and they believe these seven planets, these seven stars, control the fate of the universe, so much so that the Roman emperors would put seven stars around their thrones and around their thrones. Supposedly, if I control the stars, I control the universe. The Roman emperor controls the stars, thus controlling the universe. But Jesus says, no. I have the universe and the cosmos in my hands. The stars don't control nothing. The empire doesn't control nothing. It might look like things are out of control, fire all over the place, flood all over the place, climate is out of whack, the nations are fighting each other, people are dying, but kings and governments and leaders aren't in control. Committees and nations aren't in control, and certainly evil and Satan is not in control. Jesus is the king of the universe. He is in the middle of the church. From his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword. His words cut through things. It cuts through the nonsense, cuts through the pretense, cuts through the resistance, all the way to your heart to heal you, to mend you, to chop out that evil and to mold you and shape you. His words change people. His words is here every week in this church. he still speaks from the middle of the church. And his face was like the sun shining in full strength. The sum of everything that John saw was like the sun shining in full strength. All of its glory, its brilliance, its power, its warmth. He stands in the middle of the church, not away, not out of it, not above it, not far from it, in the middle, here. Remember what the church is going through. People are struggling to follow Jesus. There's oppression everywhere, pressure to do what everybody else wants them to do, to blend in. There's temptation to indulge in pleasures and sensuality. Some are suffering, some are holding on, some are giving up, some are letting go. First thing God wants the church to see, this spiritual reality, is Jesus is still here in the middle of the church. The King, with eyes of fire, with feet of bronze, with voice of authority of the ocean, with the universe and the stars in his hands, who speak with a sword, whose glory is blinding like the sun. He is in the middle of the church. He knows everything. He sees everything. He has power over everything. And he's still the King. That is the spiritual reality you can't see with your physical eyes, but you have to see and believe with your spiritual eyes. What is your reaction knowing that he is here? What is your reaction if he starts walking towards you? When John saw him, he fell at his feet as though dead. John's reaction was fear. But when Jesus came near, John didn't feel threatened. He didn't feel scared. He felt assurance. He felt courage. He felt confidence. Because Jesus laid his right hand on him, saying, "Fear not, I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades." This first line that Jesus gives in this drama contains three of the greatest miracles ever. That first line is what the churches needed to hear to get the strength and the faith and the reverence they need to continue to follow. Jesus says, "I died." Yes, everybody dies. You will die. It's a final boss nobody can beat. All of us here will die at some point, but Jesus came back to life. First miracle. Second miracle, he didn't just delay or postpone his death. Jesus is alive forevermore. Death doesn't apply to him anymore. Time doesn't confine him anymore. The thing that mankind fears the most, death itself, does not threaten our King. The thing that the churches was most afraid of, that does not scare our Lord. He will live forevermore. That's the second miracle. The third miracle, he didn't escape death. He didn't run away. He wasn't running for his life. He wasn't evading death. He went there and he defeated it. He beat the boss, that final boss that nobody thought can be beaten. He beat the boss, destroyed it completely, stripped him of its power, and took his keys. So death does not apply to his churches anymore. Because Jesus has final say over life and death. Fear not. Don't be afraid of me. I am with you. I am in the middle of the church. I walk with you. Certainly don't be afraid of others. that empire may be scary, but I have the keys. I have final say. Don't be afraid of what's going on in the world. Don't be afraid of what others may think when they laugh at you, when they isolate you. Hold on to me. I have never left you. And I will never leave. I was dead, but I am alive forevermore. I haven't gone anywhere. I'm just a curtain away. I'm in the church, still here. And I know you, and I see you, and I hear you, and I have my hand on your back. I have your back. Fear not. I am here. Church, don't let what you can see with your physical eyes distract you. Don't let what is happening in this world overwhelm you. Don't let what people say to you and how people make fun of you. Don't let all these things make you afraid. Certainly, don't let the world lure you away. Don't let this physical world lead you astray, because there is much more to this world than what you can see. Things are not only as it seems. When that spiritual curtain is opened, the first thing, the first scene that you must remember is Jesus is still King. He is still here, only a curtain away. Fear not.